Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, whenever you are tuned into the Asian Highway. Welcome back. We are in episode 3 of our second season of Storytellers in Action. This is your guest or your guest host or your real host. I don't know which one you call me, Dimash, but
I don't know. It's a host.
I'm hosting something, right?
Hosting something.
Yeah, we're here in Little Tokyo at Visual Communications. Thank you to the group here for having us here yet again. Thank you to Marvin UF for producing again. And we're going to have a great guest today from Orange County, back-to-back weeks. Believe it or not, we're behind the orange curtain, Dimash.
I know, the orange curtain in Little Tokyo.
That's kind of a weird marriage there. Our guest is Tian Vo. She is a journalist from the Voice of OC, and we'll talk to her in a second about her musings as an investigative reporter, and we'll talk about her background and all that good stuff. But first, Dimash, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty excellent.
Yeah?
I'm really excited to be here. You can hear it in my voice.
Yeah, well, I think you're upset because Gina's not here today.
I am, but you know what? I think we have a wonderful group of people here. I'm very excited to talk with T and yeah.
So let's bring in T right now. T, hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I like how you said hello, like as if she's like really far away. Like,
hello, can you hear me way over there? She's sitting right next to me.
Everyone can see it, right?
Right, exactly. Everybody can see us talking.
Like the
right?
time we raised our hand.
Yeah,
like we are seeing Crazy Rich Asians. Like
we all raised our hand.
It's an audio-only podcast. So.
Did you watch it yet?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm like behind in the times, I know.
Oh, well, you'll have to watch it soon.
Yeah.
So let's chat with you real quick. You're from the Voice of OC. Tell us a little about your work.
Sure. So I started working at Voice of OC about 4.5 years ago, right out of college. I'm from Orange County originally. I'm from Anaheim, but I went to school in Philadelphia, and then I came back to work for Voice of OC. So now I cover a couple cities, Anaheim, Garden Grove, Westminster, kind of like the core of Little Saigon, the Vietnamese community. Mm-hmm. And then I also cover county politics writ large. So I cover the DA, the sheriff, transportation, kind of just a random mishmash of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
And since our topic of this season is identity, we always have to ask the question, where are you from? No, really, where are you from, and how do you answer that question?
Right. So I'm Vietnamese Chinese. My parents are both Vietnamese boat people, but my mom's side ethnically is Chinese. Mm-hmm. So they left China, came to Vietnam. She was born there. She speaks like Mandarin, Cantonese, Vietnamese. But I grew up, you know, ethnically Vietnamese.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use this kind of as a segue to bring it back to you, Dimash. Let's remind people, and also this will help with T as well, of what is our podcast about?
Right. So our podcast, and I love when you ask me this question.
Yep. Like, it's an affirmation.
The affirmations. You beat me to the punch.
Sorry.
So the reason we do this podcast is because, you know, we want to tell the story of the Asian and Asian American experience. And it's our hope that it fosters dialogue when we have guests like you mm-hmm. and other people tell their stories of what it means to them to either be Asian or Asian American. And really, it allows us to kind of come to this table, so to speak, this proverbial table, and have these discussions to kind of find some level of commonality.
No pressure.
It's a lot of words, but it's actually not that complicated.
Okay. Yeah.
So we have a couple of things in common. We both had a fellowship together back in about 4 years ago.
Right.
And at your favorite university, right?
At my most hated university. I'm a Bruin, and this university that hosted us was USC, so boo.
Right, so we both did a health journalism
fellowship. And yeah. That's the other thing we have in common. We're both journalists.
Yeah.
So this first question I'm going to toss your way is actually something I think you might be related to. Dimash kind of heard about this, what happened this morning. I think I briefly told you about this before we started. Mm-hmm. I got a voicemail today, and it was in response to an investigative story I was working on. And it was a 10-minute-ish voicemail, so really long. And about minute 9 or 10, this lady's trying to talk to me about sea lions, because that's what the investigative story was about. And in the context of talking about sea lions, she says that boaters in any given harbor or marina are just guests, and that the water is truly the sea lion's home, and that the boaters are not native. And then she says, they're not native like me, because my last name means I'm not native to North America. And that she called me a non-native, which is kind of weird, because it's more than weird. It's almost racist, right? I mean, I'm born and raised in California, and I'm being accused of being not native.
And kind of California is native to this continent.
Right, so exactly. So my question to you is, how would you handle that if someone told you that in your face?
I mean, so there's like two things, right? There's like the knee-jerk reaction you have where you get really frustrated and tired of hearing that kind of thing. But for the most – I try to be as generous as possible or just assume like – so like from the context of like my family, my parents – like my mom isn't terribly educated. She's the kind of person who didn't have a lot of schooling and stuff. So she's the kind of person who would say that about white people or about other people. And so I always try to think about like – if I was trying to explain things to her, how I would couch it. And so people say things like that to me, or like I, when I was in college, I went to school at this like elite liberal arts college in Philadelphia. It was like a Quaker school, Haverford College, very like expensive and whatever. And they gave me scholarship to go there. And I had, when I was interviewing the, I can't remember his title, it's like the VP of finance, the guy responsible for fundraising massive amounts of money for this extremely wealthy endowed college. And I remember he was like, "Your English is so good." I was like, "Yeah, I have perfect English. I'm from California." But I was like, I stopped myself for a second. I was like, "All right, whatever. Like, just going to put that aside for a second." Right. And so there are like different levels of it, right? I mean, he was clearly like a super educated dude.
Right.
But on the other level, you know, I kind of – I sympathize with people who just like – don't have the tools, context, or language to talk about this stuff.
Right.
And so I try to put my like frustration aside and just be like, all right, that's fine. You know, yeah. I am native. If I'm from here. I'm born here. I literally have no other context but here.
Yeah.
But I see where that comes from.
So how do you have that conversation? I mean, you know, you're talking to somebody who is equally educated to you and they make a comment like that. I mean, is what is the nature of that conversation you would have with them? Do you let it go? Do you try to at least have a reasonable educational conversation with them? Where do you go? Is it case by case?
I mean, it's case by case. If I'm literally interviewing someone, I immediately let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not about me. Mm-hmm. It's about them. I just sort of like, that's kind of the I think that's the frustration of being a journalist, is you absorb all these blows, people who like make lots of assumptions about you, and you just set it aside for the sake of, I need to talk to you. I need to hear what you say. And it's kind of like the very like frustrating, like weird violence of being a reporter, right, is that you don't really matter most of the time.
Right.
And so I get frustrated by that a lot because I it's not just like racial stuff. It's like men versus women kind of stuff where people say things to me that are just like extremely irritating. In any other state of mind, I would say something or ask them about it or confront them about it. But a lot of the times I let things go because
right.
I just want to diffuse situations, get someone talking, make them feel really comfortable with me. And, you know, even if you're confronting someone, it doesn't have to be confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it puts people on the defensive. So most of the time, I just let things go. And I ask people, you know, at the most part, I'll ask people questions about why they said a certain thing or whatever. But I feel like it's often my job to just walk away from things.
Okay.
Which is at times disappointing, mm-hmm. but it's mostly what I have to do at the time.
So I want to do one more follow-up before I hand it back to
sure.
Dabesh. So now juxtapose that in your context as a reporter at Voice of OC, and if you can answer that, both in terms of what your job is and what Voice of OC is as a publication.
Well, sure. Can you
so what's like, you know, you let things go, but if you're pursuing a story, you can't let things go. So what's the pursuit like as a professional journalist investigating something? How is that? How do you switch back and forth?
I mean, it's like in the racial context.
No, just in general.
Oh,
yeah. And sometimes you may come across a racial interaction along
I mean
the way.
So it's frankly it's mostly sexist stuff like uh-huh. I've had men who are like my sources long-term mm-hmm. people I interact with a lot do things like kiss me on the cheek or on the head as a greeting or mm-hmm. just kind of like be weirdly touchy or say things that are uncomfortable and I just let it go
mm-hmm.
I just kind of sometimes I'll say something like hey don't do that again and then I'll change the subject really quickly or I've had like sources like sext me, like text me sexual things and then I'll tell them off about it. But ultimately it's like, it's always this trade-off. Like there's a part of me that wants to be extremely satisfied and just rip them to shreds. And then there's the other part of me that's like, all right, like if I need to maintain a relationship with you in the future, I'm going to talk to you reasonably, tell you not to do that again. And if it happens again, I'll just cut you off. I won't interact with you again. But you know, there's no part of me that really gets to, I don't know, like do things for my own satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when it comes to journalism, it's just, I mean, it doesn't become personal.
Right.
You know, people either answer the questions or they don't.
Right.
They tell you or they don't.
Right.
And then that's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and thankfully, like, the stuff that I write about is usually pretty clear cut.
Yeah.
It's government, money, documents kind
yeah.
of stuff. And
yeah.
so if people don't answer the questions, I leave. I'm done. I write my story.
Yeah.
And they can they can say whatever they want to say about me.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. The best you got something you want to throw in here?
Yeah, T. So, you know, we were, before we started recording, I know we were talking a lot about how you grew up and like growing up in a sort of Asian household or a Vietnamese mm-hmm. household. And you were just talking now about a lot of the sexism that you face sure. as a female reporter. I'm curious to complicate matters even more with your roots or your background,
uh-huh.
you know, as Vietnamese American or Asian American, along with dealing the challenges of what you face as a reporter. How do you deal with that? Like, how do you mediate through all that? Like, your identity there, any kind of, you know, things that you get from family and stuff like that, and then you have to like step out of that world and go into the world that you just described, where you're out and you're investigating and things like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny because I'm second generation Vietnamese. My parents came here as refugees, and then I cover the largest sort of concentration of Vietnamese people outside of the country itself. So, like, historically, geographically, politically, it's a very significant population, and there's a lot of pressures mm-hmm. that come with that.
Yeah.
And I feel wholly unequipped to do that. I don't feel like I have any level of cultural cred or language cred or whatever it is required to do that. But here I am doing it mm-hmm. because I'm just covering government, and I try to do it the best I can. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel equipped to do it. You know, I'm as a kid, I went to Vietnamese school for like 10, 12 years on Sundays. Mm-hmm. I always did that, but I was a terrible student. I just didn't like ditch class and stuff and not do my homework.
Ditching school on a Sunday?
I know.
Shame on you.
I was a very good student, but I just like Vietnamese school just made me feel really discouraged. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't like, didn't get along with my parents that well when I was younger. And so it's just like a huge source of anxiety. I don't feel like I'm super Vietnamese either. Like whenever mm-hmm. I go in the community, I feel like I'm letting people down or something. And so I come into it with like this like incredible level of like just like humility, like oh God, just like I just trying to listen and figure out what the fuck's going on. But at the same time, I'm an indignant person. You know, when I walk into a room and it's a political situation, you know, sure. someone's giving a speech or it's some big community event, I've tried, you know, when I first started, I wanted to do a story about the Vietnamese American, like Vietnamese language media mm-hmm. environment. And so I was trying to interview other reporters and cameramen and people who always showed up to these events. And some of them were very nice and some of them wouldn't give me the time of day. Like I would just walk into a room and they just would look past me, or it was like I didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so there's still always this feeling like when I'm talking to politicians or like Vietnamese people in these like very official contexts,
yeah.
I feel like I'm at home and I'm supposed to be serving them tea, because my dad's super traditional. Like if any like man that age came into our house, it would be like me right to the kitchen, go pour tea for these guys and like yeah. make them feel comfortable. And that's still the position I take when I like enter these spaces. And so I feel like no level of authority. I'm just kind of doing what I think is right, you know. And it's very strange. Like generationally, I'm mostly dealing with people who I don't have a context for their life. They don't have a context for my life.
Sure.
Whereas like here I am trying to write about them politically from sort of a mainstream political point of view,
yeah.
but trying to contextualize them too. So it's very awkward. There's no level of like I don't pretend to know everything, but I don't know. I'm just trying to interpret it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, being as a journalist, and this is something I kind of relate to culturally mm-hmm. on the Indian American side. What is the relationship between being a journalist and being a Vietnamese American? And answer that culturally, in the sense that, like, for example, on my end, if I were to say I'm working for the LA Times, I get credibility. If I say I'm working for the Log, where I do now, mm-hmm. it'll be like, oh, okay, cool. It's kind of like brushed off as whatever.
Right. Yeah.
How does that interplay work in the Vietnamese culture? What's the relationship between being a journalist and status? Is there a mockery of the thing, or you have to work at a certain status level?
I mean, it depends. Most people, like Voice of OC is an online publication. Most people who speak English don't know about it, much mm-hmm. as people who are monolingual or from like a different ethnic background or whatever. But you know, when I tell people I work for an English language online newspaper, they're usually pretty skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid that I'm going to get things wrong. But because of how I look and my age, like most other Vietnamese people are pretty generous with their time. Mm-hmm. For the most part, like when I talk to them, they speak at a pace I can understand. They explain, they over-explain things. My level of fluency and stuff. People are very generous with their time, but they are worried. And I think it's totally valid, you know. Like most mainstream media doesn't cover non-English-speaking communities well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand it. I think people, when they approach it, like if I said I was from the LA Times or the Orange County Register, people would know. You know, mm-hmm. they would be like, oh, okay, like this is the level of deference we give.
Sure.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like if I tell people what I am, where I'm from, what I need from them, and they're extremely generous.
Sure.
With
sure.
At the you know, the worst part is really just that most people are afraid of English-speaking media.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I'm Vietnamese, they're like, you know, you're young, you don't understand what I'm going through, and mm-hmm. I totally get that. So right. there's always a barrier there.
Sure, sure.
It helps I look the way I do.
Sure.
But it doesn't, like, you know, bridge that whole gap.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
You explained, you know, a couple of situations where, like, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, cultural subtext involved. Like you were saying, like, you see some of these politicians and you're like, you know, maybe I should be serving tea or whatever, you know. And, you know, the roles seem very defined, right, in the way you describe it. Have you ever encountered a situation like that where the reaction you thought you were going to get was, it was like completely opposite, where they're just like, it's not what you expected, I guess?
Well, so, I mean, just to be clear, I, like, use that example as just something I, like, worry about or mm-hmm. feel anxious about. Like, if I thought about, you know, I've gone and interviewed people that were just like people who showed up city council meetings, and I go to their house, and one of them, like this woman who lived, I wrote a story about like a mobile home park that was going to close in Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
And this couple showed up to a city council meeting to complain about it. And then I went to their house later and I found out that the man's wife was actually the dental assistant for my like long-term family dentist. So I'd actually been interacting with her for like 20 years and didn't remember it. So there's just stuff like that where it's like people I know intimately and I feel like I owe something to them culturally or whatever. But most, you know, it's not nearly that explicit.
I see.
Like 90% of the time, people are perfectly respectable to me me because they know of like, here is your profession. You have you know, earned your place here and whatever. Like, I don't face that often. It's kind of like the minority of the time.
I see.
And so the weirdest part really is like, it's just different in the Vietnamese community. Like when you show up to a community event, the MC always announces the names of all the journalists in the room and they tell everybody that you're there. And when you're like, you know, if you go to like a county meeting or something or like a, you know, like a meeting run by the League of Women Voters, nobody announces you're there. You just kind of show up and sit in the corner.
Yeah, no, I think that's
and so it's just
right.
it's really formal, and there's this weird status involved with it, and it's the awkwardness comes with I think probably my age and experience, and it's I think it's more of me, like more of my insecurity about like being young and stupid. Everyone else is like fine with me. It's just the sort of like this minority of people who are kind of assholes or who are like
awkward. Everywhere. Yeah,
yeah.
And I will disagree with one thing. You said you are one of the smartest people I know, so I will vouch for that. I've known you long enough to say that.
Okay.
And which brings me to my next question, is what outlets do you personally have to express yourself, to kind of share how you feel about life or certain things you're dealing with? What kind of, if you're comfortable answering this, what's kind of your way of putting things out there of what's going through your head for any given issue?
I used to write a lot creatively. I don't so much anymore, I think, because sometimes, like, this isn't a real dichotomy, but in my head it is, of just, like, I feel like there's professional me that needs to be, like, super boring, which isn't, it shouldn't be how things be. And then there's, like, me and my thoughts and whatever, and that I like to write, and I like to draw. I draw cartoons and, like, illustrations and stuff, and I always feel extremely anxious about what I should or shouldn't be saying. And so I'll draw stuff and then I'll like burn it or tear it up. Like, just sort of like extremely violent, like unnecessary things. Because I don't know what to do with those thoughts. But I, you know, when I first started, I used to draw a lot of cartoons and stuff. And then when I started as a reporter, I started to just worry that I wasn't allowed to do these things.
Aww.
And it's a little unnecessary. I know it is, but like I feel that way still.
Well, you can take the other angle where it's actually quite necessary. It allows you to maintain some level of I don't know, balance or something, whatever works for you.
Right.
I mean, we all have our ways of, I mean, we both have our ways of dealing with our, whatever we want to deal with. It's really up to you, right?
And it'd be cool to see like a collated copy of all those cartoons that you put together or drew, you know?
Well,
like,
yeah, it's kind of screwy because when I was in college, I drew a lot. Mm-hmm. And then I kept like all of my artwork. And then when I left college, I just kind of threw it away. And so now I have like, and then I have online archives. And then I just like, well, so what happens is I get super depressed. I have like depression. So I get super depressed and I just delete everything and I like destroy everything I own. And then I start over slowly, surely. Uh-huh. Start over. But for like the most part, I just have no sense of like preservation or like wanting to, like, I'm almost ashamed of like, because like my cartoons are super emotional. So when I look at them, I'm like, oh god, I'm so emotional, I have so many feelings, oh, that's so like unbecoming. And then I like want to destroy everything. Aww. So I don't keep anything, and I'm trying to change that, but yeah.
Well, let's talk about this on a grander scale. You know, and this applies to I think a lot of Asian communities. Uh-huh. I know it's definitely the case among Indian Americans. I'm curious your take on this from your perspective. Mental health is a big issue, and, uh-huh, and to say that in the context of this, that there is a lot of like pressures to keep things in and to not share things. I think that happens in a lot of different Asian cultures. It's definitely, mm-hmm, the case with us, yeah, where you're not supposed to, you're supposed to repress your feelings, and
a lot of taboos,
yeah. And you know, it's something I don't personally subscribe to. I mean, I'm more American than I'm Indian. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of Western ways about me, and I am quite open about who I am and everything I do. I don't have any shame about that, but that's me. I know that there's mental health among Indians and South Asians in general is a big issue. Mm-hmm. I know I've talked to the Carter Foundation over Atlanta about doing a possible fellowship with them,
yeah,
to cover a lot of these taboos. And you find a lot of people that take out their issues by killing themselves or doing something harmful to themselves. So what's your take kind of on repressed emotions and feelings within the Asian community, if you talk from, at least from your perspective?
Sure. So I'm Vietnamese, and we're kind of like, we got like a special experience. You know, most of the Vietnamese people you talk to in the U.S. came as refugees, mm-hmm, or some kind of like traumatic post-war experience. And so, you know, I had no level of awareness of that as a kid. I sort of knew stuff happened, but nobody explained anything to me. My parents didn't talk about those things. It just was like this collective feeling that everyone was kind of fucked up together. And so it's a huge problem. I'm sure if you talk to any psychiatrist or any like medical provider in the Vietnamese community, they'll tell you the same thing. My parents were both boat people. They both left Vietnam in their early 20s, in like the late 80s, and that was super disruptive for them. You know, and there were people who had not really become young adults yet, and they were forced to leave their entire families and their whole context for being, and just kind of like make stuff up along the way, and like that took like a huge toll on how they grew as parents. I mean, like, when I look back on the time that so my parents met in Malaysia at the refugee camp. And when I look back at the time they spent as being parents, having had four kids together, I could tell as a kid that they weren't ready to be parents, or they just didn't know what they were doing, much less in a country where they didn't understand the language their kids were speaking. Right. You know?
Yeah.
And so my dad was extremely traditional. He grew up in sort of like rural Vietnam, like in the Mekong Delta, but his family was very traditional. It was the kind of family where you didn't sit down. When you sit down for dinner, you don't pick up your chopsticks before your dad picks up his chopsticks, you know. And he had rules like that, and we always followed those rules. And it's just like – it was like even his friends tell him he's too traditional. That's the kind of family that it was. You know, super, super traditional. And so growing up, it was like we didn't not only was he not expressive, but he was like cramming a lot of shit down and trying not to feel things just because of his experience. You know, someone who was like immensely traumatized, but also woefully unequipped to express himself. And so, yeah, that like had a lot of ramifications in the family household. So it's just kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. Like when I was younger, and I feel so stupid for having this thought now, but it's just, I don't know how else to say it, is that I thought there was something wrong with being Vietnamese because all of my friends who were Vietnamese had kind of screwed up families or extremely bad relationships with their parents or could not express anything. And then I would see all my like other friends who just had normal functional relationships, or even if they weren't normal, just better relationships. And so I thought there was something fundamentally wrong with being Vietnamese. I thought it was like a cultural issue because I had no other context to interpret it with. Mm. And so I would get into these fights with my parents, or they would just, like, my dad would just go through, like, PTSD outrages where he just, like, would react to things. And I was like, maybe he's just, like, this is what we're all like. And so it wasn't until I got a lot older and was like, oh, we pick war, traumatic immigrant experience. I was, like, kind of connected two and two.
Yeah.
But it was just kind of startling to me that I would jump to that conclusion. But I now see how I could, you know. And there's so many young people who don't connect those dots because nobody talks to them about their, you know, the history behind what their parents went through, but also just like how sort of shockingly universal that experience is.
Yeah. I want to jump this with them. And I want to get your perspective of what I'm about to say. And then I'll let you jump in with your comment. I think there's a similar overlap in a different context with Indian Americans, with the Indians that are here in America specifically, like my parents' generation, your parents' generation, Dabesh,
which is the same,
right? Yeah. In the 1960s, the floodgates opened up for Indian immigration to the United States, but it wasn't just any old Indian that came here. You had to be, you know, there was a certain, I guess, segment of the Indian population that showed up here, and it was a tiny slice of the country. The Indians that are here in the United States isn't an accurate cross section of what exists in India. So naturally, that leaves on a perception, like we think that people here might think Indians are all like smart, whatever. That you're just getting an educated slice of the country, right?
Yeah.
But the flip side of that is, and this is going back to a common experience of the group that came here, is they had a very specific goal of what they want to accomplish here. They came here to make money, get education, live a certain kind of life. And that restricted certain kinds of pursuits for my generation.
Right.
That's why a lot of us were initially going to med school, law school, engineering school, business school, because that fit within the paradigm of the mindset of our parents that came here. And they came here for a better life that they couldn't get in India.
Right. It's a privilege to go find yourself and like make a living painting or whatever, live in a box. Right. Like, it's just like it. If I were ever to do something like that, even I'm second generation, like far removed from that context in a way, I would feel guilty doing that.
Right.
Like,
you know,
I feel guilty in my current job. I'm like, I should be making more money and sending money to my grandmother.
Right. You know? And hey, look, I walk.
But isn't that more of a product of, like, the way that makes you feel? I mean, I would say as an Indian American, like, I would probably feel a certain way as well, like that in that situation. But that goes back to, like, what we've been taught from, or what we've seen from the previous generation, right? Where whether we like it or not, whether we're conscious of it or not, it is imprinted into our identity, into the way we think.
Right. That was kind of the commonality I was trying to find among our experience and the Vietnamese experience, right? So.
And to go back to what you were saying a little bit earlier, T, like, you know, you were talking about, you know, talking to the younger generation. I always like to ask, we accumulate a certain amount of insights, knowledge, whatever you want to call it. And if we really want to make a good use of it, we want to be able to disperse that information to people that are maybe where we used to be. What kind of lessons or insights have you picked up that if you were able to go back to yourself, like, you know, earlier on, or someone that's like you in your position earlier on, what are some of those things that you would share?
That's tough. I mean, full disclosure, I'm like 26, so I'm still like a child. the current context is I was, you know, I went to college at 18. I moved out, and I actually recently moved in back with my parents after ending a relationship like 2 months ago. So I'm like in this weird place where I'm a full grown adult, and like with people that I had spent a lot of time arguing with and like clashing with and stuff, and in this like new context where we have a much better relationship. But like 75% of the things I was upset about as a teenager or as a child were things that my parents were like, you know, they could say real off color stuff or just like unhelpful things. But for the most part, it's just like cultural misunderstandings. It was like what they wanted that was best for me based on what they know and what they understand with no context for how my life actually works.
Yeah.
Like the funny thing is my parents don't know me very well at all. They know a lot about what they want for me and what they think is important for me. And they know a lot about my moral character, but they don't know about what I do at work or what I care about or what I want for the world. And so we have just like some of the most silly arguments about like things where we'll find out we're like arguing over something, but we end up in the same place. And for the most part, it's just like misunderstanding. Like the best way to explain it is like me and my mom, right? My mom was someone who grew up with like no opportunity. She was so poor in Vietnam that she had 12 siblings. Her mom was single because her father had died when she was young from cancer. And so they were so poor, they would like collect the scraps from restaurants that you'd like, you know, you'd empty all the dishes into a big bin and then there'd just be all this food mixed together in the bin and they'd buy a bag of it and then they would just all split it up in bowls and eat it at the end of the day. That was, you know, how they grew up. And so she grew up that way. Her mom wasn't there for her. She has no concept of parenting, super traditional family. And so when it's like my world where I get to like have a job and do things and make choices and take birth control, it doesn't mean like it's just we're on a different plane.
Right.
And so we used to argue about stuff all the time that like when I look back at it, it was just like her telling me what she was worried about based on her crazy ideas about like American culture or what dangers I would be facing. And I would think it was her being condescending or not trusting me or whatever. And then now that I'm older, it's just like, we're just not talking to each other.
Wow.
And so that's kind of like, that's what I feel sad about most of the time, right? Is like, it's like, the upsetting part is, you know, when I was younger, my Vietnamese wasn't as good. It's much better now. And so we can actually talk to each other and we have a real exchange of ideas and we have real conversations. But when I was younger, it was like us saying things past each other. And I really regret the time we spent arguing over things that we said to each other and we weren't really listening or understanding. And that's the tough part, though. Yeah. It's like it's hard to say who's to blame for that.
Sure.
I think that's just a pretty universal experience.
Sure.
So a little while ago in your explanation, you know, you were saying how your mom may not quite understand what you care about and what you want for the world. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, what do you care about and what do you want for the world? What's important to you?
I mean, so the reason I do my job is that sounds like very, I don't know, lofty. I care about the truth. You know, I want people to have access to information that means something to them, that helps them understand the world, and does it in a context they understand. So as like a Vietnamese woman, I get tired of reading mainstream media articles about other Vietnamese people that's just kind of like not helpful or accurate or gives people a context for their true power. So, like, I don't know, what's a good example? Like politically speaking, you know, we've got a big election coming up. Orange County has four big congressional races that everybody in the country is looking at because it could change the balance of the House of Representatives. And every article I read talks about, you know, Laguna Beach in South Orange County or whatever. And nobody's talking about the – some people are, but not that many people are talking about the huge South – or the huge Korean population in Fullerton or something. And their context for the way they see this election or the fact that Young Kim, who's the main candidate, Republican candidate there, how long she's been a TV personality or how long she's worked for the congressman there and the community group she's been in. It's all this sort of like far removed – discussion about like demographics and voter registration and stuff. And like when you think about it, this county that we live in, it's Orange County, a county that I know, like when I read articles about Laguna Beach, it's like, yeah, okay, that's a community in of its own. But when like Orange County I know has always been deeply immigrant. All of my friends and family have been other Asian or Latino people. And I don't recognize the world that other people are describing, and that bothers me. And so as a writer, I want to describe the world, not only that as I see it, but, you know, it's just this part of the county and the country that people just have been describing based on what they think they know, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
First, I want to validate something you said. You talk about being lofty and search for the truth. I'd say you're among like company here.
Yeah.
You know, that's my same ambition. I mean, mm-hmm. we're different ages. I'm 41. You're 26. But I would say I share your passion and your vision. I could say the best, who's the same age as me, also feels the same way.
Yep.
So you're definitely in like company. Marvin's sure, definitely yeah. very good at what he does also in the field he's in, being a producer and podcast host himself. So you're in like company, as it were, on that level. And I do want to help give context to your quick explanation of Orange County, just to compliment what you said. There are, Eddie, I think you'd agree with this, there are two Orange Counties.
Yeah.
There's the South and there's the North. And the north part of the county is like you said, much more immigrant. It's much more diverse than the south side. And so, you know, when people talk about Laguna or Newport or wherever, that's south half, and Fullerton, Anaheim, Santa Ana, that's north half. And politically, they're quite different, right?
I mean,
so just to give some context to that, and I want to finish with this. You have on your right forearm a tattoo. Can you describe that for me? And I'd love to relay to people what your tattoo means to you.
Okay, so visually, it's an 11-headed bodhisattva. So a bodhisattva is kind of like it's kind of like the saint of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. It's people who reach enlightenment, but they forgo it in order to stay on earth and help the rest of us figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so the bodhisattva of compassion in the type of Buddhism that my part of the world practices, Mahayana Buddhism, mm-hmm. there's a story about how she's tasked with given this enormous task of figuring out all the cries of suffering of mankind. It's super overwhelming. She doesn't know what to do. So her head splits into 11 pieces. Her body shatters into like 1,000 pieces. And so the Buddha gives her 11 heads and 1,000 arms to cope with that task. And so that like traditional imagery you'll see of like the 1,000-armed Buddha, that's where the story it comes from. So I guess I got this tattoo. I am Buddhist. I was raised Buddhist, but also just the personal context is mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, there's two parts of it. One is that I've always tried to be there for other people and extend myself for other people. In a context where it's just like to listen to people and just not think about yourself completely, let yourself go, not feel self-conscious about who you are and what you want, and just be there for someone else, I think is a very special experience. It's mm-hmm. hard. Most people have struggled with that.
Sure.
And so it's a reminder for me to do that more. Mm-hmm. And it's just be there for someone and listen to them and be fully present for them. And then on the second part of it is also to not destroy yourself with that task. Sort of just be there for everyone all the time, sort of like personal therapist for like you and all of your 200 Facebook friends or whatever. and just remember to take care of yourself too.
Sure.
So it's just kind of a reminder for me about like the difficulty of balancing those tasks. Like,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I want to thank you for allowing us to listen to your story. We were quite pleased with having this discussion. So thank you for taking the time out to open up to us. And
you're a great storyteller.
Yeah, you are. Okay. So we really appreciate what you had to say. Dibesh, why don't you folks tell us where you could find us online for where the podcasts are available.
Right. So you can find our podcast on iTunes, on Google Play Music, on Spotify, and the Google Podcast app, as well as any other podcasting app you like listening to.
Sure. And you could also email us if you want at asian.highway.live@gmail.com. Facebook, you'll find us, just type in Asian Highway 1. We're on Twitter. Our handle is AH1Live. Our Instagram handle is also AH1Live. And we also have our website, which is AH1.live.
What a shocker.
I know, right? It's quite consistent. Dibesh, where can we find you on Twitter?
So I'm on Twitter at @FreshestDibesh, and
where are you? I am at Parimal Rohit, PARIMALROHIT.
That name doesn't sound like it's from this continent, by the way.
Oh, no, it doesn't. Obviously, the name is not from the continent, but I am, so that counts. I do want to give another shout out to Dean Sultani, who made our intro and outro music. So special thank you to him. Again, thank you to Marvin Nguyen again for producing. And thank you to Visual Communications. This is Pimo and Dibesh. We had a great chat with T today. She's from The Voice of OC. Do you want to give a shout out before we head off? Are you good? She's good. Okay.
She's done shouting.
She's done shouting, yes. So on behalf of Dabesh and on behalf of Gina, this is Pimo. We'll be back next week with another guest. Her name is Sati. We'll talk to her. She's a filmmaker. We'll get into about some of the righteous stuff she's working on. So on behalf of H1,
be good, y'all.